So nice to have you back, Pep.
Great to be with you, Nima. Thank you.
And let's get started with BRICS. And we've learned that the Cuban president was invited to BRICS. And he was invited by Russian Federation. Is that the case, or somebody, or the whole BRICS countries, all of these countries decided to invite him?
Now, this is how it works. I think it's important for you and for our audience to understand how it's the very complex BRICS mechanism works throughout this year under the Russian presidency. They can invite anybody they want, and they did invite a lot of non-BRICS members so far, of course, to the program called BRICS Outreach, which is essentially the BRICS Plus meeting, where you have potential BRICS candidates or nations that the Russian presidency deems very important to be part of these discussions, which are parallel to the big BRICS meeting of the... and now it's complicated again. It's BRICS 9 or BRICS 10, because we still don't know exactly what is the Saudi Arabian position. It's still very, very tricky. They are not fully committed with BRICS 10, but they say we are part of BRICS. So it's they haven't defined their status yet. But BRICS Outreach is very interesting. Do you know, I'm sure many of you know that Palestine was invited. And this is not 100% sealed yet, but there may be a special Palestine discussion with the BRICS and BRICS Outreach. That will include Turkey, probably Vietnam, Indonesia, you know, everybody who's in the top tier or the second tier to get BRICS admission, probably starting next year. Because this year, and this remains the official Russian presidency position, there will be no expansion. This enormously important BRICS meeting in Kazan next month is to consolidate the presence of the new members. They should be all feel comfortable discussing all these thorny issues on the same table. And of course, the most important of all, which is an alternative payment system, cross-border payment system, the drive towards not yet a BRICS currency, but BRICS trade with their own currencies, which now among them has already surpassed the US dollar. So this is already a very important indicator. Transactions, trade, commerce transactions among the BRICS members now are mostly in BRICS members' currencies and not in the US dollar. So this is one of the vectors ahead. Very, very important. So this is how it works, essentially. The thing is, there will be a lot of guests that are not part of BRICS next month in Gaza. And that's what makes it so important for the whole global South, the whole global majority. The whole planet will be watching this, scrutinizing this meeting, you know, in detail.
And you mentioned the situation of Saudi Arabia. And yes. Why is that? Because nobody understands what they want to be. They want to be part of BRICS. They want to be closer to the United States. Because at the end of the day, they have to decide about this. It's so important.
I agree with you, Nima, but try to explain that to MBS. MBS, he's still hedging his bets. Let's say up to the last minute. And the last minute is going to be next month in Kazan. All the, you know, absolutely out of sight projects that they have come up with for the development of Saudi Arabia, you know, NEOM, whatever, for the moment, the whole thing is stalled. And there is not a lot of Western investment in Saudi Arabia. MBS knows that the future of Saudi Arabia is Eurasia as a whole. he knows that his future in terms of selling oil is China. So this means that the future in terms of transactions is going to be the petrol yuan. So he knows that the future of Saudi Arabia is directly linked with BRICS. But there are many, many issues. They have excellent relations with both Russia and China. And at the same time, they are warming up to having, let's say, a normal relationship with Iran. And this thanks to the efforts of both Russia and China. So let's say that next month they finally understand what's really at stake in the long run. And they say, now we are part of BRICS 10, period. But this has not happened yet.
Yeah, it seems that the position of Turkey is so important and would help the situation with Saudi Arabia. How do you find that these two countries?
It would, Nima, because, well, first of all, there's a lot of Saudi investment in Turkey. And there's a lot of Turkey, especially real estate Turkish, big Turkish companies investment in Saudi. Very, very important because I'll have an enormous chance to see this on the spot. I'll be in Istanbul, I think, in 2 weeks. So it would be great because then I'll see on the spot and talk to my local sources, academic scholars, sources, especially diplomats. What is Erdogan really up to? I'm sure they're going to tell me all sorts of crazy stories because most of them are secular Kemalists. And they are not particularly fond of Erdogan's shenanigans. But it will be great to get an inside view in Istanbul if Erdogan is really now making a strategic long-term move with enormous repercussions. Of first of all, he will be accepted at BRICS. There's no question about that, number one. Number two, let's assume that Turkey enter BRICS formally next year. Strong possibility. What will be the US and NATO's reaction? You cannot be a member of both. It's out of the question because the war, one of the parameters of this war is that this is a Western war against BRICS. Don't forget that the three top so-called existential threats to the United States, according to the Americans, are Russia, China, and Iran, which we can say nowadays, over and over again, these are the three crucial BRICS, even more than India. And we're going to see how India is going to behave next month in Kazan, because India wants to be on the forefront of BRICS, which they are not at the moment, because India considers itself a leader of the global South. So if you are a leader of the global South and you are within BRICS, you have to be on top. And for the moment, they're not. They are a side actor at best. So this means they have to make up their mind on what they're going to do with the Quad. If they're going to become an active member of Quad or basically tell the Americans, okay, we're part of it, but not doing anything in practical terms. And of course, if they are willing to finally solve the remaining problems they have with China. And that's where Russia comes in, because Russia is the mediator between all sorts of India-China problems within BRICS and within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as well. So this brings us to the key theme when I talk to people who are involved in the organization of BRICS. For instance, this week, one of my dinners was, one of the key persons in our dinner was a representative of the BRICS Business Council. So these people are right in the middle, in the thick of the action, you know. And they always say, yes, India, you know, manage India-China is very complicated. The only ones who can pull that off are, of course, the Russians. And they have been trying for years, even to the point of Putin getting Modi and Xi in the same room and Putin acting as the mediator in person. This already happened in past summits, you know, very, very serious. So next month, we have an opportunity to have all these major global South actors finally getting their act together and starting to act as a cohesive whole. Very, very important. For instance, One of the persons in this dinner that we had this week, where they were basically briefing me in detail about a lot of stuff, de-dollarization, problems inside BRICS, expansion, etc. He said he remembered Henry Kissinger, and this was brilliant. I'm going to use this in a column. He said, when anybody wants to call BRICS, who do they call? Nobody knows. No, nobody knows, in fact. Who are you going to call? Putin, Xi, both the Iranians? Nobody knows, So you need some sort of, even if Lavrov is always saying we don't want to be a formal organization with a secretariat, rules and a stack of rules like that. But you need a cohesive agenda, and especially a framework and vision, where people can pick up the phone, and if they speak with different actors, they're all going to be, that's it. This is our common agenda. And BRICS still don't have that. And it's fascinating because it's a work in progress, Okay? And the fascinating aspect is that you're trying to build an alternative system of international relations from scratch, practically, using all these multilateral organizations. BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasia Economic Union, projects from the Belt and Road, the Russian notion of greater Eurasian partnership, and the Turks, they have their own vision of Eurasia integration, which is Turkic-based, based in the organization of Turkic states. So you have to put all these things together. And as Lavrov said correctly, everybody has to feel comfortable at the table.
And you mentioned Turkey and being part of NATO. The question is, what's the point of being part of NATO for Turkey? Because they wanted to be part of the EU. That's why, in my opinion, they joined NATO, because they thought that after joining NATO, it's going to facilitate the process of joining the EU, which was failed. And right now, even the United States is not willing to sell them fighter jets. Mm-hmm. And there is no alliance there. And if they think that's realistically on what's going on with them and the European Union together with the United States. But right now, do you think that with Erdogan, because recently he was talking about Crimea, it was so unbelievable. He's thinking Crimea, yes, is part of Ukraine. How did they perceive it in Russia, considering the position of Turkey and what they're talking about?
Well, the main internal problem, Nima, is that this is something that I learned last week when I was spending a lot of time in Istanbul. 90% of the Turkish establishment, including the military, they are Atlanticists. So, the brainwashing is a matter of decades. So it's not going to change in a year or two. So assuming Erdogan is not alone and he has a team around him, deeply involved into this geostrategic move from NATO to BRICS, he has to convince Turkish elites about it and the benefits for them as well. And because these people are very greedy, by the way, and even the people who are around Erdogan, they are very, very greedy oligarchs. So we're going to have extra development and investment opportunities all over the BRICS countries. Okay, let's do it. Much better than in Europe, where we don't have many. So this is a geoeconomic issue in terms of internal Turkish politics. Very interesting to follow how this will develop. But the fact that the brainwashing proceeded in parallel to time after time, when they were trying to make a move to be accepted by the European Union, they were rejected. So now they already understood that we will never be a member of the EU, period. So that's number one. Number two, as you pointed out correctly, what the hell are we doing with NATO? What are the real benefits for us? Are we going to be involved in a terror organization. Nowadays, NATO is a terror organization de facto, which is not only against Russia, but against the global South. So NATO has plans to be really global. Well, they already intervened in the intersection of Central Asia and South Asia, Afghanistan. They already intervened in Northern Africa, Libya. So they want to be global. They want to intervene all over the world. So I'm not sure that, not the Turkish ruling class, but the Erdogan and the people around him are exactly on in sync with all that, you know. So the whole development of the Turkish dilemma ahead is going to be something fascinating to watch, really. And the and the Russians and the Chinese, I'm sorry, they're betting on it. And even the Iranians as well, because the Iranians' relationship between Turkey and Iran is getting better and better, not only on energy. So we have powerful players inside BRICS who are welcoming Turkey with open hands. And Erdogan, who loves to be courted, of course, like an Ottoman emperor, in fact, he likes that. He's well received. He's going to be one of the top members of the club, unlike his position where he's still treated as a pariah in Europe.
Do we know what would be the policy of the new president of Iran? And what's the latest information? Because everybody, when he came into the power, everybody was talking about him. What he's going to do, he's going to get closer to Russia and China and the BRICS, or he's going to go after some links to find some sort of solution for the difficulties they're having with the West. And how do you find it right now, the policy?
He's trying to strike a balance, Nima, and it's very complicated. Don't forget that these people are more or less heirs to the Zarif era, right? And Rouhani era. And of course, they want some sort of accommodation with the Americans, which is going to be extremely difficult, especially if we have Trump in power. If we have Trump in power, forget it. As it stands, Pezeshkian wants sanctions relief, obviously, which is not going to get if Trump gets to power. So this is very, very complicated because it affects directly the well-being of Iranians and the way of life across Iran. At the same time, don't forget, very important, Iran is about to sign a strategic, an enormously comprehensive strategic partnership with Russia. Both presidents are about to sign this. In fact, this will be not during the BRICS summit, but they are already organizing another visit by Pezeshkian to Moscow here to sign the agreement with Putin. So now we're going to have an interlocking strategic partnership between the three main actors, Russia, China, and Iran. Now the three of them will have interlocking strategic partnerships, partnership with each other. So that solidifies completely, I would say, the top tier of the BRICS camp. And it's not by accident, on the contrary, that guess who are the top three existential threats to the hegemon, according to the hegemon itself? Russia, China, and Iran. So that's where we are. You know, it's... the future of BRICS, the future of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the future of the multipolar world, this is part of the Iranian agenda from Ayatollah Khamenei down, including this government. Even though, of course, because there are people in this government who want some accommodation with the West, they still believe, okay, maybe they can get better business deals with the Europeans. That's quite possible. But with the Americas, depending on what happens in November in the American elections, not going to happen.
Yeah. And in the European Union, Serbia, is BRICS or has BRICS received any sort of request on the part of Serbia to be invited to the BRICS summit?
Not yet. In fact, that this is one of the things that's being debated this week in Moscow. Okay, Russia, two possibilities. Russia could invite Serbia, or Serbia could, let's say, invite itself diplomatically. But it will have to be an invitation from. We still don't know if this is going to happen within the next few 4 or 5 weeks. It's still possible. It will be an enormous boost for Serbia, because they will be in the BRICS outreach group. They will be with other fellow nations from other latitudes in the global south. Very important. And it would break Serbia being strangled by NATO, etc. They are in a very, very tough position. They are surrounded. And obviously, the EU and NATO are like this, like vultures over Serbia, right? Considering Russia-Serbian ties, which are up there, first class, they can come up to the summit observer level. They don't even need an invitation for that. Diplomatically, of course, we could have, for instance, a Serbian ambassador here, or even Vučić himself.
Do we know what was the outcome of Xi's visit to Serbia recently?
More Belt and Road projects. Of course, extremely important. Serbia is an essential node of Belt and Road in Eastern Europe. So that's just, it will be totally cultivated by China. And in case of BRICS, China will be the first supporter of, let's call Serbia to our club.
And talking about the conflict in Ukraine, Pepe, recently we had a warning from Putin to NATO, if you attack us, we're going to respond. And we had a meeting between Starmer and Biden. What's your understanding about what has happened in that meeting?
Well, I don't want to repeat myself. I talked about this in other places. But essentially, the short version is that they chickened out after that famous Putin interview in the street in St. Petersburg, lasting 1 minute, where Putin basically said, look, if you alter the rules of the game, if you change the nature of this conflict, we'll act accordingly. Because then we interpret that the US and NATO will be at war with Russia. And then Ryabkov, deputy foreign minister, he said something even more, I would say, striking. He said, okay, if that happens, our response is going to be very nasty. So obviously they heard the message in DC, not necessarily the zombie in the White House and not necessarily the Biden combo, but the Pentagon, which deals with military matters. They understood the message. So there's no US green light to use attack and S against targets inside the Russian Federation. And the Brits, of course, because of their atavistic pre-great game in the 19th century, absolute hatred of all things Russian and acute Russophobia, they think they can do it by themselves. And so we are in a limbo. You know, it depends on if they have storm shadows somewhere. Where are these storm shadows? Poland, Romania? Do they have everything that it takes, all sorts of NATO crews and organizers and advisors to operate these storm shadows? So everyone here, including the Kremlin, we can say, they are waiting for, let's say, the first attack, if that happens. It could be something that happens in the next few days. It could be a sort of October surprise. That will not be a surprise. It could be something before the American elections. So that's where we are at the moment. But clearly they chickened out when Putin was very diplomatically quite forceful and said, look, that's it. You know. so this is the real deal. And of course, considering that the reaction of American think tanks and mainstream media all across NATO staff is always the same. Ah, red line after red line, and he did nothing, he's weak, blah, blah, blah. It's the same bullshit, because obviously they don't understand how the Russians think and how the Kremlin is strategically regarding not only the SMO, but the transition from the SMO to a counter-terrorist operation, and that's what it is in Ukraine, plus the gains in the battlefield in Donbass. And the Russians totally understand that the real war is not going to be now. The real war is going to be within the next few years. And NATO itself has already given away the game. For the project NATO 2030, in internal NATO documents, if you read the whole thing, it's over there. It's by 2030. So we still have 6 years ahead of us. When they, NATO, which means American generals and their vassals in Brussels and from different capitals, think that they will be remilitarized enough and with enough troops to attempt something serious against Russia. The Russians know all that. Russian SVR, foreign intelligence, they know all this upside down, because they see what's happening in Scandinavia. They see the Baltic Chihuahuas, you know, creating a storm after storm of Russophobia. They see the Intermarium, the way it's being organized from the Baltic to the Black Sea. They see how the new Iron Curtain is being built. Nothing escapes the Russians, and they are prepared. And they are prepared for now, if anything happens, and they are prepared already for 2030. Not to mention the ultra-hardcore weapons that they have, which these clowns from Washington to Brussels seem to ignore. Everything, the Poseidon nuclear submarine, King Zhao's, Zircons, Avant-Garde, you name it. And this can change, if there is a war, this can change the war in a matter of maximum 2 hours, or even finish the war in 2 hours. Russia has, okay, NATO starts a war against Russia. Russia can bomb everything in terms of lethal and crucial NATO infrastructure, airports, everything else, in a matter of minutes. We have decent military analysts. Not American, of course. Martyanov is one of them, who have been explaining this over and over and over again. But obviously, because these people live in a bubble, in the Beltway in the US, and especially in Brussels, which is an enormous bubble. And so it configures what I have already described, and I'm trying to emphasize this practically every week. We are in the middle of a war of terror, not on terror, which declinations, the great declinations of this new chapter of the Forever Wars is Gaza, now Lebanon, which is a war of terror. What happened in Lebanon these past few days, it's pure terrorism, undiluted terrorism. And of course, all these attacks against civilians, which continue in Donbass, in Belgorod, in other Russian regions. So this is the West's plan B, because the humiliation on the terrain is already, wow, stratospheric, and is going to get much worse from now on, with every possible scenario on the table, with the war. Basically, they are achieving their strategic objectives, let's say within the next few months or until the end of 2025, every possible scenario is on the table for Russia. And they are not in a hurry. Why? Because they already told the Americans directly, this is going to be solved in the battlefield. And we decide when it's over, according to our Russian national interest. So nothing that comes out of plans for conferences, proposals of ceasefire, all this bullshit, you know, because he has to respond to the Russian now demands, explicit demands, it's going to be unconditional surrender of Ukraine with a list of things that a possible new government in Ukraine will have to fulfill. That's it. Everything else is blah, 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 amplified by the Western media, as we know, you know.
Yeah, since this conflict started in Ukraine, whenever we talk about the relationship between the United States and European Union, we thought that the United States, specifically Antony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland, were forcing the European Union to get involved even more with the conflict in Ukraine. Right now, it seems that Europeans, Starmer, Macron, are so obsessed with Russia. Do you understand their behavior right now?
Of course, of course. It was always like this, Nima. Come on. There are different levels of Russophobia among the European elites. Some extremely acute, like the Brits. Some slightly less acute, like the Germans. And some are totally hysterical, like the French. But it's more or less the same shit all over. Because the directives, they do not come from NATO or toxic Medusa at the European Commission. They come from Washington. This essentially is dictated by Washington, then goes to NATO, then goes to the European Commission, and then goes to the capitals. We have to keep reminding people of the chain of command, the actual chain of command. Just to give an example that I think it was yesterday or this morning, the exiting slab of Norwegian wood, Stoltenberg. Basically, even as he is exiting his post, he keeps selling the same stupidity of peace is war, literally. He said that 2% of GDP for each member of the European Union and NATO, it's not enough. It has to be much more. For what? To continue the war against Russia using Ukrainians until the last Ukrainian, of course. Because it's not going to be until the last Pole or Romanian. Because the Poles and Romanians won't go to Donbass to be slaughtered. It's Slavs against Slavs, so Ukrainians will continue to be slaughtered. So this is the official... In fact, Stoltenberg is basically parroting the official NATO position, which never changed and it will not change. That's the whole story, in fact. They never had a plan B. This plan B that came out now, it's out of pure desperation because some people with IQ over room temperature, especially in Brussels, they see that the cosmic humiliation ahead is going to be wow. So we have the war of terror in parallel to the war of terror in Gaza and Lebanon. But the overarching picture, the big, big picture, is all of that comes from DC. All of that comes from the American ruling classes. And of course, the usual suspects that we cannot name because then they come after us. Next step, they're going to try to explode our iPhones. You know. Sorry. Sorry, but it's quite a possibility.
Can we say that, considering what Sikorsky said in his talk with these two Russian pranksters, can we say that NATO is not going to be involved officially in this conflict with Russia? They're not going to put troops on the ground.
Well, they are already at war with Russia in every possible aspect. Considering that they are extremely cowardly, and they know that they don't have enough troops with enough training to put on the ground to face the best army with all its shortcomings, the best professional army in the world, the Russians. They can't. It's ridiculous. They'll be slaughtered. Just like the Ukrainians are being slaughtered, and just like NATO advisors are being slaughtered as well. So that's it. So it's an enormous PR operation. Rhetoric, fiery rhetoric, threats. But the Russians don't care. It's amazing. The Russians are like an immovable bear, in fact. They don't care about anything. Throw anything against the bear, so what? You know. And they are exercising enormous restraint. This is part of our running conversation, all of us independents. If there was this enormous restraint on display, Moscow could have eviscerated Kiev in 20 minutes. Literally. The decapitation of the head of the snake is very, very easy. Everybody's a target over there. You know, a few kinzhals on Bankova, and that's it. A few kinzhals on Budanov and his gang of terrorists, that's it. Very easy. But so what next? That's not the point, because the war is not Kiev and Ukraine. The war is against the collective West. The war is against NATO as a whole. The war is against Otanistan. NATO-stan, sorry. So that's it. That's the long-term Russian vision. Incomprehensible in the West, obviously, you know, because these people, they cannot plan even for next week. Can you imagine planning for the next few years or even the next decade already? And Russia, they have the know-how, the manpower, and the IQ and the preparation and the solidity of this ruling class to think about these terms. And what we see here in Moscow are different grades and different levels of how fast Putin should be going in terms of finishing this off. There are a lot of people who said, no, this should have finished yesterday. This war should have ended months ago. And there are a lot of people who also understand that the Russian vision is a very, very long-term vision, because the war against Russia by the collective West will not stop anytime soon, if ever. They are very realist. Very, very realist. At the Minister of Defense, at the Minister of Finance, Minister of Foreign Relations, with all their internal problems, once again, and there are many. But they are quite realistic. And they see what happened with the strategy so far, with lots of setbacks, of course. But look at the geoeconomics. Russia is the third power in the world by purchasing parity power ahead of all the Europeans. Russia expulsion of SWIFT, who cares? They are trading with everybody from the global south, global majority. Russian president of BRICS, it's the most important year in the history of BRICS, and Russia is in the driving seat. These are only a few examples. And, of course, in the battlefield. And even all the weapons that they have not even introduced to the battlefield yet. They don't need to. And the fact that they are doing this the Russian way. Very slowly, attrition war, little by little, one village here, one village there, not in a hurry. Encircling, creating cauldrons, which is going to happen in Kursk sooner or later. In fact, sooner rather than later. This is the Russian way of doing it. And it's all that is working. So they're not going to change their strategy, because their strategy and the way they thought this war, they sought this war for the next decade at least, because they know this is not going to stop. This war will be remixed, and there will be another major attempt by the collective West to go after Russia. So they know all that. So when you see the big picture and the long picture, let's say the Chinese way, like the Russian leadership does, then you can make plans that last, in fact, and you keep tweaking as you go along. So in this sense, the Russian strategy has a Chinese element to it. It's fascinating. The Chinese always plan, as you know, 5-year plans. They already plan at least until 2035, if not until 2049, the Chinese. The Russians are doing the same thing, but in a much more complicated environment, because in the middle of it's a hot war for all that. For all practical purposes, it's not Cold War 2.0. This is a hot war with an inbuilt component of a war of terror, of a hybrid war of terror, which will go. The Iranians are, or the Ukrainians, I'm sorry, they're not going to stop tomorrow with their attacks on civilian infrastructure in Russia and against civilians themselves. So the Russians have to be prepared to all that. So this, I think this, I try to give to all of you in the audience the range and the complexity of what they're up against. Can you imagine the collective West threw everything that they had against Russia, and Russia not only survived, but it's thriving. Live with that.
Yeah. And they don't understand it.
No, they can't. They can't, Nima. They are psychologically, congenitally incapable of understanding. First of all, because they don't understand the other as a whole. And this applies not only to Russia and Slavs, but to Persians, to Chinese, to Arabs, to Islam as a whole, to Africa, to Latin America. Of course, they don't. They don't make the effort because they still believe that everything that they have enjoyed so far, all this enormous coterie of privileges and the privilege to exploit the rest of the world, for the past roughly 250 years, and in the case of the Americans, to rule the world since the end of World War II, they think that this is eternal. They think this is God's grace. They think that they deserve it, and they think that they can get away with everything that they do. Bye-bye. Not anymore.
Le Monde reported that Zelensky, one of the points in Zelensky's victory plan,
this is the joke of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, he's asking for an invitation on the part of Biden to be. He wants to be invited into NATO, but we know if Biden is not willing to do this, nobody would do this in the future, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, but. The best option right now for Zelensky and for Netanyahu, even for Netanyahu in Israel, is Joe Biden in office. How do you find, do you think that Biden would even just, it's not official, just it's not going to be a commitment on his part, but an invitation sending to Zelensky?
First of all, Nima, there's no Biden. I'm sorry. That thing is a zombie. He doesn't make policy. He doesn't have decisions on the table. The Biden combo does it. And then that opens up Pandora's box, because the Biden combo is not necessarily only the vassals, the functionaries, the messengers, Sullivan, Blinken, all this gang. It's the donors of the Democratic Party and the wealthy people who support the Democrats. So this goes to a vast section, not vast, but a substantial section of the American ruling class. These are the people who are telling the Biden combo what he should do. They know that if they have the zombie telling Zelensky, yeah, I promise you're going to be part of NATO, nobody will take it seriously. Nobody anywhere. First of all, because this is not feasible, and second, because if this is a formal promise, the Russian response is going to be, okay, so now we destroy everything in Ukraine. Could be, for instance. So this is media blah, blah, blah. It doesn't mean absolutely anything. First of all, because this administration is on the way out, the zombie is already a lame duck president. The guy in Kiev is a lame duck ruler, which can be, there are two possibilities for him. He's thrown out of the bus, or he finishes like Mussolini, hanging upside down in the public square. These are the only two feasible possibilities. The third possibility is he is exiled in one of his mansions all over the world, like the one in Miami, for instance, and somebody one day will go there and finish him off. And the most, if we look at history, recent history, the most feasible path is that the Americans will drop him like they drop other past rulers who served their purpose for a while, and they become totally irrelevant after a while, which is the case of Zelensky now. So all the options for him are dire, to say the least. The only thing that, because he has this, don't forget that he's an actor playing a role. This guy knows less than zero about everything. Military matters, cultural matters, international relations, foreign policy, diplomacy, etc. So he's like, we have a lousy actor playing a role. And his ego went out of control because, of course, all the collective West was applauding. Nah? Until the moment when they're not applauding anymore. Apart, of course, from toxic entities like the Medusa in Brussels. Von der Leyen, she's in Kiev today, né? If I'm not mistaken. She is in Kiev right now, once again. But that's obvious. These are top American installed and controlled assets who keep playing the game. And of course, they have to say the same thing as they did, like Stoltenberg, the same thing. Ah, we're going to protect you, we're going to give you more money, everybody in Europe will give you more money, etc. This is not the main. The main plot is what happens to Ukraine after the absolutely outstanding defeat in the battlefield in Novorossiya. Will other European actors try to grab parts of Western Ukraine, which they feel entitled to, and historically they are? What's going to be left? The rump Ukraine? And what kind of profit BlackRock can make out of all this? This is what matters. Everything else is blah, blah, blah. You know. And, of course, the fact that they already lost the most productive and wealthier lands in Ukraine, which are in the east. And in Donbass. This is gone, over. So they're going to have a lot of rich agricultural land. So this is what matters for the financial interests, etc. The fate of the government in Ukraine, the fate of the Ukrainian population, which is being decimated, nobody cares about it and will never care about it. They were just, and they still are, cannon fodder, period.
I think we can see it, that they're going to leave them as they did in Afghanistan, in Iraq. They're going to just leave the place. Then
they're going to be. Of course, Nima, because then it will be counterproductive. The whole plan failed and it's going to fail ignominiously. So it's going to be way more ignominious than the exit from Kabul 3 years ago, which we knew it would happen. It was just a matter of time. And when it started to happen, it happened in a matter of 10 days. I remember it happened in a matter of 10 days. The Taliban conquered everything that they needed to be conquered on the road, literally, in Kabul, where they already are Taliban cells in Kabul, in 10 days. So the whole American 20-year occupation basically disappeared in 10 days. The same thing can happen in Ukraine. Absolutely the same thing. Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
And of course, but the difference, they'll be back, Nima. Afghanistan, they will try, but forget it. Afghanistan now is being incorporated into the Eurasian, the whole Eurasian ethos. They will be part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Russia and China are investing. Afghanistan now, that's it. Forget about the only thing the West has in Afghanistan from now on is terror. But Ukraine is more complicated because they will be back. So there will be a, let's say, reorganization of Ukraine. We don't know in what terms, but the collective West will try to use Ukraine once again to undermine Russia. We can say that this is a fact of life for the past few decades and for the next ones.
Yeah, the way that we can connect the conflict in Ukraine and to what's going on right now in the Middle East is this mindset of terrorism. And they did this with Russia, this terrorism in Moscow and in Chechnya. And right now it's in the Middle East, in Lebanon. They started with this, as you've mentioned, with the pagers just exploding. Walkie-talkie is the same way. And it seems that the strategy is the same, making some sort of insatisfaction, unrest within the society to force them to say them, they're not protecting you. Putin's not capable to protect you. Hezbollah is not capable to protect, to help you, to protect you. That's why you are in danger. You have to change your policy. This is the same way. How do you find it right now in the Middle East?
Well, it's what I write about week after week, Nima. It's the development in different levels of the war of terror, because the only thing they have left, and how the forever wars that started even before the millennium, we can say that the first forever war was the destruction of Yugoslavia in 1999, how they have progressed through the Pentagon-denominated war on terror, and how now, especially now, since Gaza, they have metastasized into a war of terror, because they are losing on the back on the battlefields all across the spectrum. It's very, very sad, and it's very, very sad, the ramifications of all that. For instance, the ramifications of this pager walkie-talkie attack all across the world. The main thing that they achieved is to install an atmosphere of fear everywhere. Everybody now will be looking at smartphones, laptops, everything, and said, what if this thing is tweaked? What if it's going to explode in my face or explode in front of my children? You know. So this atmosphere of global fear is perfect if you are controlling the narrative, and if you don't want anything to change, and if you want people to be cowed, submissive, and looking behind their backs, you know. So this is extremely vicious. But I'm sure that the people all across the global majority, they are smart enough to understand what this means. And they won't, they will keep resisting. They won't back down. Exactly what Nasrallah said in his very calm and composed speech yesterday in Beirut. We will not back down. The resistance as a whole will not back down. And the global south, the global majority, the multilateral organizations, especially BRICS, they won't back down. And this will increase the levels of dementia of the Western plutocracy to levels that we have not seen yet. We're just seeing what they are capable of. They are capable of indiscriminately killing civilians with electronic devices. This can go anywhere now. Now there are no red lines. This reflects the absolute desperation of these people looking at, you know, it's getting closer and closer, the end of all those elaborate privileged plans that they had. It's not going to happen anymore. It's a tough struggle, thorny, complicated, with lots of internal divisions that have to be thought about and dealt with. But this historical process is irreversible. I think none of us could ever imagine that this could happen so early in the early 21st century. It's still, Eric Hobsbawm who still define us as the young 21st century. We still are. But it's already happening. And thanks to a great deal of what Russia and China have been doing this past few years. And Iran as well. So these are the three major nodes of this new multinodal world. And three civilizational poles, which is also very, very important. It's a return of great civilizations against a bunch of usurpers, essentially, and a bunch of Western savages, essentially. You know, so When we look at it and we see the auspicious aspects of what's happening nowadays and from now on, we have reason to be, okay, slightly hopeful in the middle of so much horror, literally, all around us. You know?
Just to wrap up this session, in your opinion, right now, Netanyahu is trying to convince his people to go to their home in the northern part of Israel. He has sent a lot of weapons, tanks to that region to just pretend that he's going to protect them. But in your opinion, the way that he's trying to convince them, is he willing to sacrifice them in order to make a bigger war with Hezbollah?
Well, the key story is he needs a forever war being renewed over and over again, because if he doesn't have it, he will go to jail. So this is the most base and absolutely disgusting personal profit angle that you can imagine. So he's willing to sacrifice everything, including, in many aspects, Israel itself, to his own destiny. In fact, if they try a ground war against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, they will be slaughtered, eviscerated. They can bomb the whole of southern Lebanon. That's another story, and turn it into a wasteland, and then bring the people who lived nearby, you know, which is a strong possibility. If they actually try to go fighting village to village in southern Lebanon, I've been there, I saw it, they're going to be eviscerated, and they know it. The people with the brain in the IDF know it. And they know that this strategy by Netanyahu is completely suicidal. But it's the only thing he got left. He didn't achieve any of the so-called objectives in Hamas. In fact, he lost the war in Palestine. He killed a lot of people. He organized a genocide, and he still lost. So now he's going to lose in Lebanon. It's going to be part two, you know. And probably if that happens, it's going to be probably a lot of Lebanese will be sacrificed, and this will be horrible. But they, don't forget, Nasrallah, very important. What Nasrallah says reflects his base, reflects what we see when we talk to somebody living in near the border between Lebanon and occupied Palestine. We'll not back down. We are armed to our teeth. We'll defend our land. And if they come here, they're going to regret it big, big time. So this is where we are again. It's a replay of 2006. Huh? Remember what happened in 2006. So now if the Israelis try something similar, wow, their humiliation will be complete. Who cares in terms of Netanyahu and his cabinet of mega fanatics? They don't, you know. Horrible. Absolutely. It's beyond, the situation is beyond horrible. People all over the global south and the global majority, they are, you know, they are stunned. They are, you know, seething with rage, and especially at the impotence to defend not only the people in Gaza, but also to defend the people in Lebanon. So in the end, For all this to end, I wouldn't say end, but has some sort of revolution, there will have to be a military operation against these people, against these fanatics. It's going to take a long while. It's going to be a concerted axis of resistance military operation. But this will eventually happen. It will be the only way to teach them you cannot get away with everything, especially what you've done for the past year. You know, history will be a bitch. Karma will be a bitch. The verdict of history is going to be unforgiving for what happened this past year in Gaza. So history always finds a way to, you know, engender unforeseen outcomes, right? So one of these could be finally There has to be a military operation to teach these people some what real life is all about. And this is what the global majority wants, essentially. Not only the whole of Islam, but the whole of the global South and the global majority want, because this would be a form of restoration of justice. And only with demonstrations, only with petitions, only with appealing to the UN, only with writing and all that, it's not enough. Yeah, you have to go for the jugular. And history tells us that if you don't go for the jugular, nothing happens.
And what was important in Nasrallah's speech, that he was so calm and he wasn't willing to make a bigger war. He totally understands the situation. On the other hand, he knows how important a war of attrition is in order to defeat Israel.
Because this war of attrition is the great legacy of General Soleimani. He defined the parameters. He put in the mind of his commanders everywhere, in Syria, people he talked to, in Iran, in Syria, in Palestine, in Yemen, in Iraq, especially. Look, guys, this is the master plan. It's up to you in different latitudes, but this is a very, very long struggle. And you have to be prepared for major setbacks like this one in Lebanon this week. But don't back down, and they won't. Yeah. And that's it, you know. So the other side, when they see that, they are scared because this is now a real counter power with many ways of inflicting pain to Israel, and they will do it, and they won't back down. That's it, you know. This is a do or die confrontation, very, very serious.
Yeah. Muito obrigado, Pepe. Grande prazer.
Enorme prazer. For all of you, enormous pleasure.
Foi bye, muito bye. Bom conversar tchau. Contigo.
Obrigado. Bye, bye.
Tchau, tchau.
Tchau, tchau. Tchau, tchau. Tchau, tchau.